Hey, everybody. Welcome to Movie Crush. Charles W. Chuck Bryant here in the home studio, Pond City Market. Intro and outro, guest recorded by Jerry. How exciting is that, everyone? First time she's been involved in this show because she really doesn't care about it otherwise. It's not true. So this week, everyone, I had another drummer in, which was great. I had Mr. Eric Slick of the great band Dr. Dog, Philly's own Dr. Dog, one of my favorite groups. And this is one of those where I was like, hey, I love Dr. Dog. They're coming to Atlanta. Wonder if anyone from the band would want to be on the show. And as it turns out, Eric Slick is a big movie fan and is a big, Big Lebowski fan, and got back in touch and said, I'd love to come on and talk Big Lebowski. And we did that. What a great, great movie. And I know a lot of you are very excited about this. So Eric and I sat down and talked about music, about Dr. Dog, a very interesting story, how he got involved. And he's just a really cool, interesting guy overall. And then we dive in deep on the Big Lebowski. And it was a lot of fun. So without any delay, here we go with Eric Slick on the Big Lebowski. Yeah, I do a formal intro before and after. So
yeah. I checked in yesterday. I wanted to make sure that I wasn't going to be totally unprepared. I also rewatched The Big Lebowski.
Yeah, oh, well, that always helps.
It does help.
I had, do you know The Walking Dead, the TV show?
Oh, yeah.
I had, you know, the guy that plays Aaron, Ross Marquand.
Yeah.
I had him in yesterday and for Die Hard. And we've both seen it. We were kind of laughing. We've both seen it dozens of times. But there's something different about watching it analytically for something like this.
Oh, yeah.
And taking notes. And he did the same thing. He came in with notes. Those are always the best ones. So
yeah.
Thanks for rewatching Lebowski.
Oh, well.
It's not like it's a chore, but.
It's not a chore. And it's one of those movies I could watch over and over again. And it's like a tattoo on my forehead.
Right. You know?
It really is.
So you were from Philly originally?
I'm from Philadelphia.
Nice.
Yeah. Born and raised.
What a great town.
Oh, man. Philly is the best. It's changed a lot.
Yeah.
Much like Atlanta has changed a lot.
Sure.
But Philly is amazing, and it's a huge part of my cultural and just my DNA.
Like, yeah,
I can't take the Philly out of me.
It's one of those towns, I think, too. There's a lot of pride.
Yeah.
For a city.
Yeah.
Philly pride.
Some would argue pride in excess. we're a town that really thrives on the pride of its sports teams, even when its sports teams have been utter failures.
Oh, yeah, man. I've got a couple of really good Philly friends that are, you know.
Lifers. Yeah.
Are you into the sports at all, or?
I'm a fair weather fan, unfortunately.
Right. Well, you're doing pretty well then lately.
Yeah, well, this year is a great year for us.
Yep.
You know, my dad was like crying tears of joy when the Super Bowl happened. But, you know, it was like the first Super Bowl I've watched in full probably in like 5 years.
Yeah.
And I was like jumping around my house. I mean, I was excited.
Well, you had the same, well, not the same experience as me as a Falcons fan, but up until it all went bad, we had the same experience where I feel like the whole world was on your side. Mm-hmm. The whole world was on our side, mm-hmm. unless you're a New England fan.
Oh, my God.
Nobody wants to see them win unless you are literally a New England person.
Yeah.
Like, everybody wanted Philly to win.
We have a reputation for being underdogs, and we also just seem to have a lot of curses against us. I mean, we haven't won a Stanley Cup since 1974.
Yeah.
The Eagles have never won a Super Bowl.
Yeah.
I don't even know. I don't think the Sixers have ever won a championship, that, to my knowledge. The Phillies, obviously, we had in 1980.
Right.
We got really close in 1993.
Yeah.
2008, ironically, I was in Vilnius, Lithuania when we won, and I was so bummed.
Uh-huh.
And actually, the rest of the Dr. Dog dudes were in Australia when the Phillies won, and we were all just like pretty heartbroken.
Yeah. Well, the Phillies are looking good again. Sixers are better than they've been in forever.
Forever. Yeah. But the Sixers, we got close, but we didn't make it.
Yeah. That was a disappointing playoff run, but it's the first of what will be many.
I hope so.
Yeah.
I mean, as a Philadelphian, but I'm an expat. Like, I don't live in Philly anymore. I live in Virginia now.
Okay.
But as a Philadelphian, I want us to succeed in every possible way. I mean, like, I grew up with Philly being like working class.
Yeah.
You know, it's different now. It's very European or something. I don't even know how to describe it. There's like 5 coffee shops per block now.
Right.
But I grew up with it being, of course, I grew up being a very working class place. Like, So whenever any victories happen, we are just like, oh, yeah, yeah, you know.
Yeah.
We would burn the city down.
Right. In a good way.
In a good way. We burn the city down, yeah.
Where's the band spread out? It sounds like everyone lives in different places.
Yeah. So our Scott McMicken, uh-huh. our singer-songwriter, lives in Tucson, Arizona now.
Right. That's cool.
Frank, our guitar player, lives in Jersey.
Uh-huh.
And hopefully I'm not blowing up anybody's spot. Toby lives in Delaware. Zach is the only one left in Philadelphia.
Okay.
He's the dude hanging on to Philly.
It seems some of my favorite bands are spread out bands and don't like all live in the same town together.
Absence makes the heart grow fonder.
Yeah. I've got the Pavement shirt on that you remarked about. They very famously didn't ever live together.
No. No.
They're all over the place.
They are all over the place. And you know what? The more I tour and the more I hang out with bands, like, it's just becoming a thing. Mm-hmm. You know, like, people want to feel comfortable and maybe, like, their hometown doesn't make them feel super comfortable.
Right.
Philly eventually, for me, became a place where I was a drummer in 13 or 14 different bands.
Seriously?
Yeah.
That's such a drummer trope.
Such a drummer trope. But good drummers are in short supply.
Yeah, exactly.
So I was like in an absurd amount of bands. And one day, you know, I realized that my tour life and my home life were the same thing.
Uh-huh.
And it just was exhausting.
You were always out with somebody?
I was always out with, I mean, I'm still always on tour, but like I wanted my home life to feel distinctly different
mm-hmm.
than my tour life, because tour is insanity.
Yeah.
And when you come home and then you're like, all right, I remember I came home from vacation. I was on vacation in the Virgin Islands. I came home and I played a gig.
Mm.
You
had to cut it short or you
I
just...
know, like I was on vacation for a week and then we landed in JFK and then I drove down from JFK to Philly and then immediately played a show.
You can't even go home and have that unwind experience.
Nothing.
Yeah.
You know, I remember at the time I was like, I should turn my phone off during this vacation. But then the better half of me was like, no, what if there's a call?
Right.
What if there's a call? You might need to take the call. I think that, so speaking of Philly being working class, I think that working class attitude is instilled in the people who are from
right.
Philly. And like, you know, it's like you, I don't know, it's not like fake it till you make it, but it's just like, you just have to keep working and working and working.
So you guys, how did you come to be in the band? Because we talked a little bit about on the elevator, but I want to hear that story because I've been with Dr. Dog as a fan from the beginning. My friend Ryan, shout out to Ryan, turned me on to them when I lived in L.A. in, I guess, like 2001-ish.
Oh, a long time ago.
Or two, maybe.
Yeah. Matt, early.
Yeah.
You were on board early.
Well, he was on board early.
Wow. Oh, sure, sure. But you both were.
I mean,
give yourself some credit.
Yeah.
That's amazing. So I joined the band in 2010, but I had been a fan of the band for a long time.
Really?
Yes. My friend Dan was like, you got to hear this band, Dr. Dog. They're a West Philly band.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, oh, all right, great. I listened to it. Totally blew my mind.
Yeah.
And then I was on, this is how long ago it was. I was like 18 years old. I was on vacation with my family.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Dog happened to be playing in Atlantic City. I was in Ocean City, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
And they were opening for the Rock on Tours, Jack White's side project band. And I was like, oh, great. This band I just heard about is playing a show.
Mm-hmm.
We should all go. So we like got a huge group of friends together and we saw Dr. Dog play at the House of Blues in Atlantic City. And
nice.
It was like transcendent. You know? And those early Dr. Dog shows, like then I would go see them play locally,
right.
like 40 people, 20 people.
Yeah,
and
same here.
And it was like, every time I saw them, I'm like, man, that's the best.
Yeah. My whole thing early on was like, man, why aren't these guys bigger?
Yeah.
Like, why am I in a room with 75 people right now?
And then the selfish part of me was like,
yeah, don't tell anyone.
No, the selfish part of me was like, don't tell anyone. And the other selfish part of me was like, I want to play drums in that band. So I became fast friends with them.
Okay.
And, you know, we were playing a couple different shows together. And the big one was, was playing with a belly dance troupe in Bonnaroo.
Mm-hmm.
I had somehow got roped into this, like...
Because you always answer the phone.
Because I always answer the phone. I got roped into this belly dance group gig where I'm playing like a doombek, like a belly dance drum.
Wow.
Yeah. And it was at the Solar Stage at Bonnaroo, and it was like this Knoxville belly dance band. They're not even a Philly band, but I somehow got connected with these guys, and... we pull up to the park, the camping area, the parking area for camping. And, a big van pulls up next to us, and it was Dr. Dog. Mm-hmm. And they were like, oh, Slick, like,
yeah,
Billy. And we were like, ah, you know, it was like this big moment. And I ended up hanging out with them all weekend.
Oh, nice.
And just became really close with them.
And poisoned their drummer.
And I poisoned their drummer. Spiritually, no. No, it wasn't like that. It was more just like I had so much respect for them, uh-huh. and I loved that band with all of my heart, mm-hmm. you know. I listened to their first record, Easy Beat, to death. And
yeah, man.
Then they had Takers and Leavers EP, and then We All Belong came out, and it was like a game changer in Philadelphia.
Oh, man, such a great record.
Such a great record. So then they took me out for my 21st birthday. Mm-hmm. Zach, the keyboardist, had this, like, little piece of paper with a bunch of numbers and chicken scratch.
Mm-hmm.
And at Bonnaroo, he was like, give me your phone number. He didn't have a cell phone. Mm-hmm. He was like, give me your phone number, and on your 21st birthday, I'm going to give you a call, and we're going to hang out no matter what the situation is. Uh-huh. And I was like, okay. He writes my number in, like, the tiniest handwriting I've ever seen on this crappy little card that looks like it's from, like, 1942.
Yeah.
Puts it in his wallet, and then a day before my 21st birthday, I get a call from Zach.
Wow.
And he's like, hey, Black Keys are playing tomorrow. We're all going. You're with us.
Cool.
You're coming with us. And that was my 21st birthday.
Wow.
So it was just like a lot of, like, they kept just being so generous to
me.
And then their drummer quit in 2009. And I ran into Zach on the street. This Zach is a big figure in this uh-huh. story. But I ran him on the street, and I was, so I had been on tour playing like progressive rock music.
Yeah.
I don't know if you know this, but like I was like deep prog.
Really?
I was playing with a guy named Adrian Ballou from uh-huh. King Crimson.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. That was my gig. I was playing with Adrian Ballou, and then I was playing in a Zappa band with all the Zappa, ex-Zappa musicians.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I was doing some nerdy drumming.
Yeah.
Like, very, like, intense, like, uh-huh. your whole life is consumed by Zappa music and
right.
King Crimson music.
Yeah, that's tough stuff.
It's really tough. And when you're in that world, it can get kind of, like, claustrophobic.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually, like, I just had desires deeper than playing complicated music. I wanted to play songs,
yeah.
you know, and that's no shade to Zappa. He has plenty of songs, but it's just like,
no, Zappa's Zappa. Everyone gets that.
Yeah. It's not like put it on at the party music.
Right.
You know, it's like,
yeah,
I'm a head case music.
A lot of people listen to Zappa alone in a room.
And I love Zappa. Zappa will always be one of my favorite musicians,
yeah.
but it's just, I had yearnings deeper than that. So I quit all those bands. And then I was like, you know what? I'm going to quit drumming. I had this in my head that I wasn't cut out to be a drummer, and I sold all of my drums for DJ equipment. Oh, my God. So even thinking about it, I'm like, what was I thinking?
Yeah.
So I ran into Zach on the street, and he's like, hey, what are you—
Quarter-life crisis?
Quarter-life crisis. He's like, hey, what are you up to? And I was like, nothing. I'm doing nothing.
You didn't say I'm DJ Slick?
I was just like, I'm going to DJ in New York. And he, like, chuckled. And he was like, oh, well, you know, it's good running into you. And then I, like, said goodbye. And as I walked away, I walked directly into a pole, like, as hard as I could. And Zach was just like, oh, like, we had that, like, movie moment where he's like, are you okay?
Right.
And I was like, yeah, man, fine. See you later. This is another weird coincidence. Like, as I was buying the DJ equipment from a Craigslist dude, he was like, yeah, you hear Dr. Dog's drummer quit. And I was like so out of it. I was just like, oh, cool. Whatever.
Right.
Like, I didn't even think of it. And then the day after Christmas, I got a call from Zach, and he was like, hey, I ran into you. You're not doing anything. Do you want to join the band? And
wow.
I was like,
just a straight up invite, huh?
Just a straight up, like, do you want to audition?
Oh, okay.
But I've later found out that I got to the studio and nobody else was there.
You're the only guy.
They were really banking on this thing working.
That's great.
But I think there was an inherent trust because we had built up a friendship over the course of like 4 years.
It just all kind of worked.
It all kind of worked. And I mean, it was cute. You know, it's like, they're like, learn 5 songs. And in the back of my mind, I'm like, I know your whole catalog.
Right.
Like, in the back of my mind, I'm like,
all right, I'll put some time into it.
Yeah, let me just practice these songs. And, yeah. But in like actuality, it's like, oh, I know your whole catalog back. So we played, you know, 4 or 5 songs. I think we ran through like Alaska. And they were like, okay, this feels good. And they're like, can you play anything else? And I was like, let's run all the records down. And they were like, really? And we went from Easy Beat all the way up until Shame Shame, and we played every record in full, and it was so fun.
Yeah.
That still might be like my favorite rehearsal I've ever been a part of. Like,
I bet, man.
Oh, it was a dream. And it felt so natural because I already knew the songs. I knew them as people. I knew that they were sweet, and there wasn't any of that awkwardness when you're like approaching a gig and you're like, "Am I doing what you want?"
Right.
So, it was amazing. And then, of course, you have that first thought, best thought practice, and then I had to go through 3 years of getting to really know everybody,
sure,
and really know what the personalities are and how to work with them. And
yeah, the honeymoon period's over. And
I remember after the fourth show we played together in Syracuse, Toby took a look at me and he was like, "Yeah, man, I don't know if it's gonna work."
Oh no.
And I was like, "Really?" I was like, "I thought I'm doing okay." And he's like, "Yeah, but you come from an improvisational progressive rock world, and we need everything to be solid."
Yeah.
And I was like, "Oh." So they really, I appreciate them for giving me a chance because it was hard. And of course, they had another drummer before I did. And then the big secret is that Scott is a monster drummer.
Oh, really?
And Scott plays drums on Shadow People. Uh-huh. He plays all the drums on We All Belong.
Really?
Yeah. It's all Scott. He is a phenomenal drummer.
Wow.
In a very janky way.
Yeah.
He's very a lot of character in his drumming. I wouldn't call him a guy with a lot of technical prowess,
right,
but his tone is really good and his ear for drums is incredible.
Yeah.
Some of the drums he did on Easy Beat were recorded one drum at a time.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. Super cool approach, very kitchen sink approach to recording.
Uh-huh.
So I learned a lot from them.
Yeah.
And I also had to be respect for the old drummer Justin and Scott's drumming while also trying to add something different to the conversation. So when we made Be the Void, the first record, that was my first record with the band. Mm-hmm. It was sort of listening back to it, I'm like, "Oh yeah, you could totally hear me shaking off the prog."
Really?
Yeah. There's some complicated drumming on that record, but sometimes I'm like, I listen back, I'm like, "Was that unnecessarily complicated?" Uh-huh.
It is a bit of a mental shift, I guess.
Well, and talk about Pavement, those guys, Toby and Scott in particular, grew up obsessive with Pavement.
Yeah.
Obsessive. To the point where if I start playing Shady Lane right now, they'll be like, "Okay, let's play all of," or if I played Range Life the other night on our bus, and then it was like, "Okay, can we go into all, can we just play all of Wowie Zowie?"
Yeah.
Can we play, or what, that's not on Wowie Zowie, but those guys, that's the world they're coming from. And Pavement had there's some shared influences Can and the more krautrock stuff. When you start going back with the Pavement, it's there's U.S. Maple and all these bands that influenced them. And then I got really into those bands and recognized that there was common ground.
Mm-hmm.
And so I could be Pavement. I could take the things I love about Pavement and the things I love about progressive rock and smash them together in a way that could be really different. Scott and Toby are huge Pavement dudes.
Same here, man. And I'm in an old man band. I got in my first band when I was 38 years old. And it's just old friends from high school and college that we all lived in within 2 miles of each other. And it was like, "Wait a minute, you play guitar, I play guitar and sing, you play drums, you play bass. Why don't we just get together?" And it's the most fun thing in my life.
Yeah.
And we only do cover songs. We don't have time to write. We've all got kids and we're all busy. But we play one or two shows a year out when a friend calls and says, "Hey, we need somebody to do 30 minutes. And my buddy was doing he's in a Weezer tribute band, and he said, "Hey, we're doing a 90s night, and we have us and I think there was a Primus thing." He was like, "Would you guys be up for learning 12 Pavement songs?"
Ooh.
And I went, "Oh, man, yes."
Yeah.
So we did that, and we played our Pavement dream set.
Two drummers?
No, we didn't have Nastanovich.
Okay.
I tried to, and I actually have gotten to know Bob a little bit.
Whoa.
Because of the podcast.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of it was one of my, big moments in life. I was like, "Wait a minute, you listen to this thing?
You got to get Malcolmus on here."
I emailed him actually because Bob gave me his email and I never heard back.
Oh, that's okay.
But his new record came out today, actually.
I know, Sparkle Hard.
Yeah.
I know, it sounds great.
I haven't listened to it yet.
Oh, it sounds great.
That's
I'm a Malcolmus I'm a lifer. And, I just read there's a New York Times interview and the Washington Post interview is really good.
Oh, cool.
And I can relate to him in a lot of ways. We're kind of, he's "I feel really awkward. I feel like I don't have a good voice, but
yeah,
I crack myself up with my music and like hopefully that's enough, you know. And
he's one of my favorite guitar players of all time.
Yep.
There was a moment at the I saw them quite a few times back in the day, but then I went to the reunion gig at the Tabernacle, actually, where you guys are tonight. And there was a moment after the first, right before the first encore, when everyone walked off stage, Malcolm was walked off stage, but we were sitting kind of to the side on that, you know, upstairs of the balcony. And he never took his guitar off, and he was sitting in the wings on a box noodling.
Yeah.
And if you were out in the audience and you weren't on the side like we were, you couldn't see that. Uh-huh. You just heard this stuff. But he never took his guitar off. And that 3 minutes was one of my favorite parts of the show.
Yeah.
Because he was just sitting there in the dark in the wings doing his Malcolmus noodling.
Yeah.
And it was fucking gorgeous.
And that's the thing about him, too, is like in this Washington Post interview, and I can relate to this because I get performance anxiety as well.
Yeah.
And he's like, you know, when we were on late night in the 90s doing Cut Your Hair, he's like, I closed my eyes for half of the performance. And he's like, because I didn't feel like, I was like, when is this going to be over?
Right.
Like, even when Pavement was playing Coachella, he's like, I closed my eyes and I was like, when is this going to be over?
Yeah.
And I understand that because like, you know, you can... When you're at home writing, you can just live in your own world and like, yeah, you can crack yourself up with your music, like play all kinds of hilarious stuff and write. I mean, some of the Pavement lyrics are so funny. Rattled by the Rush, caught my dad crying.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think about that line all the time.
Yeah.
And then it's the way that it's juxtaposed where it's like, you know, brush your teeth shirt smell, you know, it's like caught my dad crying. That's such a vulnerable thing to say. And then like the rest of that song is like, we call her Barbara.
Yeah.
Larva.
I know.
Larva Barbara rhyme.
Like, oh yeah. I'm sure a lot of times his tongue is firmly in cheek.
Oh, it's
and he's
so,
like, well, that rhymes.
It rhymes. Yeah. The Rattled by the Rush story I love the most is that he's like, I can't believe when we went back to relearn it, how slow that song is because of how high we were.
Oh, really?
He's like,
that's such a good song.
He's like, that song's like 70 beats per minute, which is like slow.
Yeah. It is slow.
You know, it's slow.
Oh, man.
They're like, we can't.
I just want to listen to that now.
I know, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we were talking a little bit on the elevator on the way up here about the organic growth of Dr. Dog, and I've seen it with my eyeballs as a fan going to see... from like the, I don't know, Vinyl at the Center Stage to the Masquerade to the Buckhead Theater to Shaky Knees, and which obviously that's a festival, but I feel like those festivals earn a lot of fans that way. Is that a strategy or is it, I mean, the growth has been so organic and natural, it seems like, because it's not like, oh, we played this 100-seat venue and then the next year we were doing 1,800 seat theaters.
No, it's not like that. And actually, like the more I see bands like immediately go from playing 100 capacity rooms to playing 1,800 capacity rooms, I'm always wary because I'm like, you're not going to be able to deal with this.
Yeah.
The slow growth is so much truer.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, you're right. It's like when I first joined the band around the time that Shame Shame was being finished, we were only playing 100 to 300 capacity rooms on that first tour. And, you know, some were sellouts, some weren't even sellouts. And this was at, like, Dr. Dog was doing well.
Yeah.
And people were aware of us. But, you know, then the next time we play, like, Iowa City or whatever, it's like, yeah, you play the 150 capacity room for 3 years. And then the next time you play the 300. And then the next time you play the 500. And then, like, you play the 500 for what seems like forever, and then you're at the 1,000, and it's like, and it feels like such a tangible, like we can all breathe a sigh of relief, like we did it, you know.
By working hard, like I always got the sense that some bands give up, when they don't hit that certain level, and Dr. Dog always seemed, maybe it's that Philly work ethic, seemed like you guys are going to go out and fucking earn each show. You're going to earn that fan to tell 10 more people.
And it never goes away.
Yeah.
And I would so much rather be in a position where it never goes away.
Yeah.
Instead of the, you know, instant like, boom, we're done. Mm-hmm. And I've seen it happen with friends' bands where they just become so jaded. Now, that's not to say that we're not like, you know, we have a sense of like, okay, like
sure.
Play in this room again. But when we go on to play the show, we never lose a sense of the love for the thing.
Yeah.
And I totally agree with you. I think, it is our Philly work ethic. Uh-huh. It is our relentlessness. And even, last night we were starting to have kind of a weird show, and then we like have little tricks that help us get out of it. And then like humor can be one of those tricks. So like we're in the middle of playing the show, and Toby looks at me and he looks like kind of crazy. Like, you know, he's like, we're both just exhausted because we've been on tour since April, beginning of April. Well, I've been on tour since January, but I can get into that later. I've been touring with two bands. So he looks at me and he says, hey, if we leave now, do you think we can beat the traffic? And it just killed me. He has a lot of one-liners like that.
I love Toby. He's like, my deep secret is like, he's my guy.
Oh, that's okay. Yeah,
he's the secret weapon.
Everyone has their guy.
That voice, man.
His voice is amazing. But Toby looks at me and just goes, so deadpan.
Yeah.
And I like lost it. Because I knew he saw in me that I was tired. Uh-huh. And I saw in him that he was tired. And we were just, you know, we're playing Fate, or, it's called The Beach on the record, but we call it Fate. Uh-huh. And we're playing through this song, and we're all just like hanging by a thread.
Yeah.
Tour's over in 2 days. We're all ready to go home and see our significant others and our friends. So it's just like, just that little moment of like, I know, like, I'm aware of what you're going through. Mm-hmm. Let's laugh about it.
Yeah.
And then the rest of the show was so funny.
Yeah.
And then we walked off stage like all like, you know, arm in arm. And that's how we get over those things. So
it's
got
to be a good feeling, you know, because you worked through something together.
It is. And I would tell any young musician that like, if you're on a slow route, just like don't give up, even even if you like aren't making a living yet doing it, like it's so much better than someone who's like, I'm famous immediately,
right?
You know, I've heard stories of people who are like Instagram celebrities who are like 16 years old,
oh,
like with like a million followers, doing like cartwheels when they find out that they've had a million followers. And
it's such a thing now to the expectation of not having to wait for stuff.
Oh,
period.
Man, it's crazy,
whether it's success or the download of a film, you know.
And there's merit to certain things, certain things becoming more efficient and communication getting more efficient. But when I see somebody like celebrating over getting a million Instagram followers, I'm just like, oh man, it's all downhill from here. You know, like if you're considering that the high watermark of your success, then like the rest of your life is going to be pretty disappointing.
Yeah.
Because there's so much about life to celebrate. And I often tell people like Dr. Dog, we like try to be like a life celebration band, you know, like
that's what the show's like.
That's what the shows are like. And that's what we're trying to convey. Like,
yep.
We're and humbly, it's not like we think that we are, you know, like, well, yeah, we're here to help you celebrate life. It's more just like, no, I mean, like our lyrics are about viewing negativity in a positive light and trying as hard as you can to be like, yeah, life is suffering, but like,
yeah,
we'll make it through.
It's always, you get something out of every band that you see live, but Dr. Dog shows are always fun.
Awesome.
Like, it's just, and I saw it at Shaky Knees, you know, when you play a big festival with a lot of people who don't know who you are, I was walking around and literally hearing people like, who the fuck are these guys?
Yeah.
Like, this is great. Who are these guys? Who are these guys?
Yeah, it still happens. Although the polar opposite of that is we played Jay-Z's festival in L.A., the Made in America festival.
Interesting.
We were one of two rock bands on the bill. We had a noon slot.
Who was the other rock band?
Weezer. Okay. We can have the Weezer conversation, but like, you know, Blue Album and Pinkerton are masterpieces, and then the rest I can, you know,
sure.
I'll take or leave. But Weezer was the other rock band, but they have a following, and they also have like a rock radio, like people are aware of Weezer.
Yeah.
But we go on stage at noon, and like the curtain drops and the crowd is just like bewildered. They're like, what? Like they had no idea what to do.
Yeah.
I just remember like staring at people and they're like looking at the guitars like, what's a guitar?
Yeah.
What's
like,
that guy?
Are they in the wrong place?
Well, and you know, it's not because, I mean, it's just the festival is so EDM heavy.
Yeah.
So the changeover between sets is 15 minutes, which if any musicians are listening, like, is a nightmare.
Yeah.
You need at least like a half an hour if you have a lot of gear.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a lot of gear.
Yeah.
So
sort of mad dash.
We had a 15-minute changeover, And it was televised, like, worldwide broadcast. Uh-huh. And we're like, we didn't even have our monitors on. And we're like, oh, okay. And then you have, and our set was a half hour. So yeah. We played, like, six songs.
Yeah.
And then we were done, like, I just remember, like, it sounded as if, you know, there's, like, that Zen trope of, like, the one hand clapping. Uh-huh. It sounded like one hand was clapping.
I thought this was going to end in a victorious, and we won them all over.
No.
No.
No. So much of playing live is falling flat on your face.
Yeah.
And it's knowing that tomorrow will be, might be better, uh-huh. You know? But it's true. We go out there and we try.
Yeah.
And I would hate it if I went up and played a set passively. I think the rest of the band feels that way.
You always get a sense that you guys are working your asses off up there to, like, deliver a fun experience.
And we tried to make it easier, and I don't think it's ever going to happen. Yeah. Even with our new record, we tried to pare things down and even simplify further, and it's still, like, it's not a walk in the park.
I love the new record.
Thank you.
It's so chill.
And, so chill.
It's like, because I kind of know Dr. Dog is sort of the rollicking bar band thing. And there are a couple of tunes on there like that for sure. But I really like the vibe of this one.
Thank you. Yeah, it was a conscious choice.
Yeah.
Trying to be a little bit more ethereal with the last two records. Uh-huh. Because we've done the rock record a lot.
Last two meaning, because you guys have put out a couple of interesting things lately.
Yeah, talk about that. I mean, it's like, we've got, we recorded Abandoned Mansions first.
Okay.
So that was 2014. And then that project got shelved for a while, got shelved until the end of 2016.
Okay.
Because an opportunity came along. We got a grant to finally put on a stage show for a record called The Psychedelic Swamp.
Right. Which is like the first thing ever, right?
It's the first thing that Scott and Toby recorded as Dr. Dog. Mm-hmm. They had another band called Raccoon that was, like, more popular around Philadelphia. But Dr. Dog was, like, their home recording project.
Mm-hmm.
And they made this crazy, like, actually a Zappa reference. It's almost like the Zappa record Uncle Meat. Like, it's really collagey. And they made this weird tape record. Like, there's, like, 25 copies of it out there. Mm-hmm. Some of it's on YouTube, like a dilapidated tape. And then we got this opportunity to do a stage show with the Pig Iron Theater Company in Philly. And The Swamp was just the right thing. It had a full concept. It almost had, like, a full libretto.
Uh-huh.
So we got money to do that. And then we did a stage show in Philly for four nights.
Wow.
with a full theater troupe. And uh-huh. It was one of the most creatively satisfying things, like, I've ever been a part of.
Wow, that's great.
But we had this great record. I love Abandoned Mansions. And I was like, man, when's Abandoned Mansions ever going to come out?
Yeah.
So Swamp took the precedence. We made a companion record to the theater show.
Uh-huh.
And so when we released it, our fans were like, what is this?
Right.
Like, you re-recorded an album? So I think it was confusing for people.
Uh-huh.
And then we toured it, but we didn't really, like, play any of the songs from it.
Yeah.
And then at the end of 2016, we lost a member that year. He quit, and it's all good. But
yeah.
It was just, like, he was a really important member in the band. And then Donald Trump got elected.
Right.
And we were like, we had plans to release Abandoned Mansions, and then we were like, well, it doesn't feel right to do anything now. It doesn't feel right to live.
Can we all go on?
Yeah, you know, like, some of the band members have kids, and they're just like, mm-hmm. What's our future looking like? So we decided to put out Mansions, and it was already set in stone, but then we made the decision to make it, we donated all the money to the Southern Poverty Law Center.
That's great.
Okay, we can't take money from people right now.
Right.
There's so much suffering happening. Let's donate it to a cause that could hopefully help people.
Man, that's awesome.
And then we took a year off from touring, which we haven't done since I joined the band.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where we got to Critical Equation.
Uh-huh.
And then taking that year off, it's you sort of realize, like, okay, maybe the band could be functioning a lot better.
Mm-hmm.
And the band could be communicating a lot better. So the whole emphasis behind this record was to find a way to get better at being a band. I hesitate to say in a some kind of monster Metallica documentary way, because we didn't hire a therapist, but we've been acting as our own therapists.
Interesting.
for this record.
But yeah. You made a concerted effort.
It was a concerted effort to do something more in the ethereal zone.
Yeah.
Because Abandoned Mansions had started to touch on that, and then The Swamp had some elements of that, but it was still very much like a really like abstract and brash record.
Yeah, I listened to that this morning, actually.
It's weird.
Yeah.
It's a weird record. Every song has the lyric swamp in it.
Uh-huh. I think I noticed that.
Yeah, go back and listen to it. It's weird. But it's also trying to tell this story. Like, if we had done The Swamp again, if I could George Lucas the situation,
yeah,
I would have like included a full like 40-page libretto with that record explaining why we did it.
Right.
But instead it's like you get the vinyl and then you're like, what is this song about? Who is Phrases and what is The Swamp? And
yeah.
Like there's all these characters that are mentioned in the lyric, but there's nothing in the booklet that would describe that. So to anyone who's listening, who's a Dr. Dog fan, I'm sorry. And if you ever want to know the story, just ask me. And
okay.
I'll try to tell you, but you might have to be real high to understand it.
Right. Well, that might not be a problem.
It might not be a problem.
Well, I love the new record. It's really great. It's got such a cool, chill vibe. And it feels like a record made with a bunch of guys in a room.
That's it. That's what we're trying to go for. We did. We were in a very small room with a guy named Gus Seifert.
Okay, I was going to ask, I saw that video that your folks sent, that kind of just short making of. I wondered who that guy was.
Gus Seifert, I first became aware of him. I went to go see Beck, and there was like a dude playing.
I just saw him like 2 weeks ago.
Oh, man.
At the Tabernacle.
Oh, man, Beck.
Yeah. I see Beck every time I can.
Did
He's
Torres open?
Great.
Do you know?
The what?
Torres, did she open?
We didn't go for the opener.
It's okay.
Yeah.
Busy people.
Yeah.
Beck is phenomenal. I saw him a couple years ago at the Ryman, and it's like you could focus on any member of the band and be like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God.
Yeah.
Smokey Hormel, the guitar player. Oh,
well, God. They're also nimble. Like, okay, are we going to be the bluegrass band, the James Brown band, or the
P-Funk?
Yeah. Exactly.
And like weird P-Funk.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. So like, you know, what you could focus on just the metal Johnson, the bass player, Joey Warrenker, the drummer.
Yeah. Oh, is that Joey? I didn't know that.
Joey, well, not the gig you saw. It was a dude named Chris Coleman.
Okay.
But Joey Warrenker is Beck's dude whenever he can.
Because he's been around forever.
Oh, my God. Yeah, totally. So, and then Gus was playing auxiliary, and he was, like, playing cello at one point. I mean, he's just, like, an all-around, he can do everything guy. And so that's how I became aware of him. I didn't know that he was, like, a production guy.
Right.
And then I became even more aware of him. My girlfriend, Natalie Prass, recorded some tracks with him in L.A., and she used Beck's band as the backup band for some of the tracks, and I just kept hearing about him, you know? And then he got the gig with Roger Waters. So now he plays...
Oh, really?
So now he plays bass with Roger Waters, and Joey Warrenker is the drummer. And
is Roger Waters not playing bass?
Roger Waters he does on some songs, but he also likes to play acoustic guitar.
Right.
And then there's also parts where he's got like a headset microphone. He's acting out the wall.
Yeah.
So
he's doing the Roger Waters
thing. He's like in a wall.
Uh-huh.
It was cool because we started working with Gus like in a break of Roger Waters touring. So like, I feel like this record is kind of Floyd-y.
Man.
There's some like real Floyd.
I hate to say trippy because that's such
it's trippy.
It is trippy though.
It's okay to say it's trippy.
All right, because it's one of those like I do my, I have my regular listening at home on the Sonos, of course. But anytime one of my bands comes out with a new record, since I was in high school, I do a serious headphone listen by myself in a room, hopefully dark, with the headphones on, and that's really where you get the full experience with the shit.
Yeah.
And I did that with this one, and I was like, man, there is a lot of trippy shit going on in this one.
It's a trippy record, and we recorded it in this, like, his converted home studio that has, like, you know that there's a Portlandia joke about, like, this is the microphone from Pet Sounds.
Right.
So the first day of recording, like, there's a Celeste, or Celeste, it's a like a very specific instrument. That's like, it's almost like a, it's like a unplugged Fender Rhodes or something.
Yeah.
Or it has like a kind of like bell like tone. And I go to play it and Gus is like, oh, that's the Celeste from Pet Sounds. And I'm like, haha, Portlandia.
Right.
He's like, no, that's,
wow,
that's it. That's the one.
I was like, did you take your hands off of it?
I was just like, and then I look at it and I'm like, oh yeah, this totally has to be. I mean, it's just like,
yeah,
beat to crap. He's like, yeah, he's like, Roger Waters money.
That's great.
He like went with his Roger Waters money, like went and bought the Celeste from Pet Sounds. Oh,
that's
my
great.
God. I could never even imagine being in that position.
I've always gotten a bit of a Beach Boysy vibe from Dr. Dog too.
Oh, it's Beach Boys worship.
Yeah. And
yeah, totally.
Every time I see, you know, you described as a psychedelic rock band, I go, they're not a psychedelic rock band. But then when I was listening through the headphones of the other night, I was like, oh, they are kind of a psychedelic rock band.
Yeah.
Because I think of something different when I hear that.
No, that's astute. Everyone tries to define Dr. Dog by something.
Yeah.
We just say we're a rock and roll band.
Yeah, like I think of Black Mountain when I think of a psychedelic rock band. I think of something much heavier.
Yeah, Sleep.
Yeah.
Sleep is a psychedelic band.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
But
you're Dr. Dog. That's how I describe you. It's like,
yeah,
you know, you always reminded me of the Beach Boys meets the band.
Uh-huh.
With some little Beatles thrown in.
We get the three B's a lot. Beach Boys, Band, Beatles.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. And rightfully so. I mean, like, those are all bands that we've grown to love. And last night we were playing through, like, we were playing through Beatles songs last night. We had, like, a big campfire-type vibe after the show in Birmingham. And we were playing through, like, but we were also playing, like, Wilburys. I mean, we were playing a lot of stuff last night. We were playing some All Things Must Pass. Like,
yeah.
But we get those three Bs a lot, and Beach Boys are obviously a point of fascination for all of us, but Steely Dan.
Yeah.
I would actually say, if you listen to Toby's songs, really try and catch the Steely Dan influence. I'm not joking.
Yeah.
Like,
I love Steely Dan.
So we have, I'm a Steely Dan like obsessive.
Uh-huh.
So I really feel like we're at a point now where we're in a little bit of a Dan zone, like, especially working with Gus.
Mm-hmm.
Gus is so hot. He's like constantly talking about hi-fi gear and like, you know, like this board was used for this classic recording.
Right.
Like we're starting to enter this like our Steely Dan phase.
Yeah.
And I'm like so psyched.
That's
about
great.
It.
Yeah.
I'm so psyched.
Oh, man. Well, I could do this all day.
Yes, we could.
But we need to talk about The Big Lebowski.
We do. I can't wait.
I appreciate you indulging me. It's funny. My lead guitarist, Eddie, is coming tonight, and we're both very excited.
Yes.
And I out of the corner of my eye, saw him texting me right now. Are you talking to him? So.
Oh, yeah. You're talking to me. And we're about to get into my favorite. I would love to say, like, 8.5 or, like, 2001 A Space Odyssey is my favorite movie.
That's
but
not
let's,
what this show is.
let's put all of our pretensions aside
and
talk about The Big Lebowski.
Yeah. Because the movies that have been picked for this have been like Die Hard, Tron, Big Lebowski.
Billy Madison.
Avengers. I haven't done Billy Madison yet.
Billy Madison is the only other one I could talk about with the same kind of fervor.
Really?
All right. Well, just because I've seen it so
Next
many
year,
times.
When you guys come back around. I'll be back in. So I watched this again last night. I'm a Coen Brothers fanatic.
Mm-hmm.
The only other film I've covered so far on this has been Miller's Crossing.
Yep.
With a comedian named Ben Acker, a good friend of mine. And surprised I haven't done Fargo yet. Someone will pick that at some point. But Big Lebowski, I think, followed up Fargo, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
Which, they make this Oscar-winning crime caper followed up by this crime caper.
Yes.
Like, they do crime capers better than anyone.
Yes, they do.
And kind of convoluted crime capers.
Yes.
But Lebowski had such a different tone, and they established it right off the bat with the drifting, tumbling, tumbleweed song.
Tumble.
And the literal tumbleweed tumbling toward Los Angeles.
And then you get Angeles.
Yeah. Yeah, Los Angeles.
Los Angeles. You get Sam's beautiful, rich baritone doing this. Sometimes there's a man.
It just sets that tone right off the bat.
Oh, and, you've got the tumbleweed, but then you're at Ralph's.
Yeah. It's such a jarring juxtaposition.
Yeah, and then you're at Ralph's and
the
you're
buzz
watching,
of
you're
the like, fluorescent lighting of Ralph's.
And like, why is this guy in the dairy section?
In his house why, coat. In
a, yeah. And like, why is he in the dairy section and why is he writing a check for 60 some cents or whatever?
Yeah, yeah, 69 cents.
Yeah, exactly. And he's like obviously trying to flirt with the cashier and she's not having it. And that opening scene, you know, it's funny. I remember when The Big Lebowski came out in 1998 and I remember reading a review of it in the Philadelphia Inquirer that was sort of like, why did the Coen brothers make this film? It's enjoyable, but why did they make this film? What is this film?
Yeah.
And, you know, I think about Weird Al Yankovic actually because he's like for me it's every other record that seems to be the one that touches people. He's like I'll have a huge record that does really well and then the next one will be one that's very personal to me and the public might not understand it.
Right.
So he had like Running with Scissors, which was like a huge record for him, and then it's like Poodle Hat. And you're like, what's Poodle Hat? You know, it's like a really weird record.
Yeah.
He's like, but he loves that record. And that's kind of the way I view Lebowski, because Lebowski's in between Fargo and Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, two massively successful Coen Brothers films. And then you have this, like, what is this weird child that they've created? Like, it's, okay, so the first time I watched The Big Lebowski, I was on my first tour.
Oh, cool.
I was 17 years old. And I was on a tour with a bunch of other 17-year-olds playing rock and roll music for this thing called The School of Rock. It had nothing to do with the movie School of Rock.
Yeah.
It was a program in Philadelphia, and we were like doing a summer tour playing like classic rock songs.
Right.
And somebody was like, we should watch The Big Lebowski. And I remember watching it and being like, I don't get it. I don't get it. I don't understand what this movie's about. And then 2013 came along. And I was on a Dr. Dog tour, and I was going through kind of a hard time. Like I was moving away from Philadelphia, and I was kind of in a relationship, but it wasn't really going that well. And I needed something to put my mind off of things. And we had a copy of The Big Lebowski on DVD on the tour bus, and I just put it in one day.
Yeah.
And I watched it every day for 6 weeks.
Oh yes,
it has become such an important movie to me as like. It you know, there's like a Zen books written about Lebowski.
Yeah.
There's even a book that's like co-authored by Jeff Bridges, like the dude in the Zen Master is what it's called, which I've read. It's a fantastic book. And the movie became part of my Zen training. I also practice meditation twice a day. So like watching this movie and meditating, like it all became the same thing. And
right.
I got so immersed in The Big Lebowski.
Yeah.
Like, to the point where by the end of week six, like I'm watching the movie and saying lines along with it. And
right.
just like, I know the script now.
Yeah.
So, okay. I drifted for a second, but back to the movie.
No. That is the drift.
Yeah.
You know, of The Big Lebowski. It will do that. It is more than a movie. I mean, clearly they're in there. I believe this is going to be the 17th year of Lebowski Fest. Have you ever been, by the way?
Dr. Dog has played Lebowski Fest.
What?
Dr. Dog played the Louisville Lebowski Fest.
No shit.
And we had to learn, just dropped in to see what
Kenny Rogers.
We learned the Captain Beefheart song from the movie where he's lying on the floor and Smokey calls him and he leaves him the voicemail.
Yeah, yeah.
The song that's playing there, we learned that song.
And Smokey is, what's his name?
Jimmy Dale Gilmore.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the thing. I could say like it's one of my favorite scenes in the movie.
Yeah.
When he says market zero, or you know, market eight, market zero, market eight, and then you're ending Smokey, you're entering a world of pain.
Right.
you know,
such an intense scene. My wife last night was like, "Oh my god!"
But there's something. It's so intense. But there's something about Smokey's. It wasn't over.
Yeah.
It wasn't over. You know, like, his character is so believable.
Yeah.
In a situation where so many characters are unbelievable, like Totoro as the Jesus, like, you're like, does that guy exist? Or, Walter definitely exists.
Yeah, which is, he's based on the filmmaker John Milius.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and actually the dude is based on a guy named Jeff Dowd. So
that's right,
They were both based on two dudes in reality. And John Milius is there's a great documentary about him, actually. But he's the guy who wrote, did he write Apocalypse Now?
Oh,
or he had something to do with it. He wrote and directed Red Dawn. He was very right-wing, but he was Walter Sobchak.
Wow.
You know, he was famous for going into offices and like pulling a gun on a studio exec.
Yeah.
And he would wear those aviator like shooter glasses and
a little touch of Phil Spector in there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just a guy who's paranoid, but like does have a big heart, but doesn't quite know how to express himself. And it comes out in rage.
Such an interesting character.
But something I say to every fellow Lebowskiite is like, there's a little bit of every character in you too. Like when I watch the movie, I'm like, yeah, there's times where I'm irrational, like Walter. There's times where I'm like totally passive and like Donnie.
Yeah.
And like, I'm just like positive, but it's, you're like, why is he so positive?
Yeah.
And then sometimes you're like the dude where you're like passive aggressive, where you're like, this aggression will not stand, man. You're like, you know, you just like you don't quite know how to express yourself or something. I don't know. Actually, I don't know if I could ever relate to the nihilist.
Nihilist.
I could be a little nihilist sometimes, but
you kind of feel Johnson.
And lingonberry pancakes do sound good right now.
One thing I noticed last night that I'd never noticed before, and I've seen this movie quite a few times too, is that the dude has so many funny one-liners. He's, as a person, if you just forget about you're watching a movie, let's say you know this guy, he's fucking hysterical, but no one ever laughs at him.
No.
He throws out all these funny one-liners, like genuinely, like clever wit, and no one ever laughs at these jokes in the movie.
Yeah.
And I noticed that last night. I was like, that's kind of funny, man. These are great lines.
Oh, you mean the line where—
Clearly you're not a golfer. Like, of course, they're not going to laugh because of the situation, but those are great lines.
Well, at least I'm house trained.
Yeah. It's so great.
Of course, you know, you can also— the something I've noticed, like the second time I watched the movies, he never calls anybody else dude. He always says man.
Yeah. He said man like 200 times in the movie.
He says man, but he's the dude. So no one else is ever dude.
Yeah.
He says man.
Yeah.
So that was something I noticed early on. But he does have a lot of funny one-liners. There's that great line when they're, you know, the classical music is playing and Lebowski's at the fireplace. And he's like, what makes a man?
Yeah.
And he says, you know, that and a pair of testicles.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
And he just goes, perhaps you're right.
He's great. What's his name? Shout out to David Huddleston.
David Huddleston.
Well, he is the Big Lebowski.
He's the Big Lebowski.
Which is funny. I think a lot of people think that's the dude, but
no,
he's the deadbeat Lebowski.
Or is the dude the Big Lebowski?
Well, you know, that's a good point.
Let's get philosophical. Or is it him? I think at times the Big Lebowski, you know, the real Jeffrey Lebowski or the famous Jeffrey Lebowski is the Big Lebowski. And then there's other times when the dude really tries to transcend himself and he's trying to be a big person.
Well, the other thing I noticed too is he's always on the path to doing the right thing. And he has figured it out. Walter's the one that fucks everything up constantly.
You fucked it up.
But the dude is kind of way ahead. He's one step ahead of everybody, despite his stoner slackness. He's kind of right the whole time.
Yeah, especially when he cracks the whole case.
Yeah. He knows what's going on.
He does know what's going on, but he's just—
Walter's the idiot.
Yeah, Walter is an idiot. And, you know, only hammered in by every thing that he tries to, you know, the briefcase full of his undies, just the whites, you
the
know,
ringer.
It's like the ringer, the whole ringer angle. And then,
so
of course, like, you know, this is what happens when you fuck a stranger in the ass and he's—
Yeah, with the kid.
They're chasing that kid down. Uh-huh. And then there's the guy in the
iron lung, basically.
The iron lung. Oh, my God. I mean, that whole side story is so fascinating to me.
Yeah.
I mean, like, the movie is about an hour. It's almost 2 hours long.
Yeah.
So sometimes when I get into the third act of the movie, especially when he's getting chased by the nihilist with the scissors.
Yeah, yeah.
Sometimes I feel like I'm lost in the dream a little bit. It's kind of how I feel when I watch Inherent Vice. Like, I've watched Inherent Vice a couple times now, and I can't necessarily tell you anything about it because it's so druggy.
Yeah.
And I feel like Paul Thomas Anderson was trying to make you feel that, and I feel like the Coen brothers are like, you're getting in the dude's headspace.
Yeah, and they had never done these weird fantasy sequences and stuff like they did with Gutterballs. that what it was called? Yeah. The dream sequence after he gets drugged by Jackie Treehorn.
Jackie Treehorn.
And the great Kenny Rogers song, of course.
Of course.
But I didn't realize this. I looked at the trivia. That in that sequence is when he's helping Maude bowl. That's the only time you see the dude bowl, actually.
Oh, yeah.
He's always sitting around.
Yeah.
You never actually see him throw a ball down the lane, which I never noticed until I read that this morning. It's like, holy shit. It's a movie sort of about bowling.
Yeah, there's tons of stuff like that in the movie that, like, I mean, there's more obvious things the more you watch it, like the whole Chinaman, like.
Yeah.
There's the first Chinaman, and then.
And like, Walter says you shouldn't say that, but then he says it.
They're not the preferred nomenclature. Yeah. But then Lebowski says, a Chinaman took my legs in Vietnam.
Yeah.
And you're like, that must have been some inside joke that went too far. Also, in that same sequence, when Philip Seymour Hoffman is showing him around the place.
And such a great scene.
He goes, yes, yes.
Yeah.
And then, but then Lebowski says, yes, yes. In the next scene. So like, they like mirror each other. And I don't know. I wonder if like the Coen brothers were like cracking up over like when people go, yes, yes.
I bet. I mean, they're very famous for their movies being very heavily scripted. And like, you don't improv. Yeah. They wrote every yeah, sure, in Fargo. Like, it was all on the page.
Same with Lebowski. There's no there's no improvisation. They said the biggest or the closest they got to improvisation was allowing John Turturro to just be that character.
Right.
Because that character was his character. Uh-huh. I think he owns the copyright for that.
He's making a movie as Jesus.
I heard that.
Yeah.
Because it's his thing. And it feels like a non sequitur in the grand scheme of the movie, but like, I'm so glad that they included it. And that ridiculous, especially because you don't realize that the song that's about to play is Hotel California.
Oh, man. So great.
I feel like it gets me every time, too. It's like that beautiful, like, classical guitar comes in. Comes in, and you're like, this is the perfect setup for the scene. And they're like, oh, yeah, it's Hotel California.
Yeah.
Which also ties into the fucking Eagles.
Oh,
man.
Yeah. Well, another great part is the fucking cab driver is so aggressive and angry that he wouldn't, like, couldn't play the Eagles. He, like, rips his ass out of the cab. It's so funny.
Do you know that piece of trivia?
No.
The Eagles, the fucking Eagles part? So the Coen brothers approached the Rolling Stones about using Dead Flowers in the movie.
Yeah.
Dead Flowers is in the closing credits. Uh-huh. They approached the Rolling Stones manager, who is, like, the biggest hard ass of all time.
Uh-huh.
And he's like, give me $500,000 and I'll let you use Dead Flowers in the movie. And they're like, oh, well, let's just like invite him over and we'll show him a rough cut of the film.
Right.
They show him a rough cut of the film. The Eagles line happens and he bursts out loud laughing. And at the end of the screening, he goes up to me. He's like, you can take the song for free.
Wow.
And he's like, he's like, but you have to use a cover. He's like, he's like, that Eagles line. He's like, that's the truest thing in the movie.
Yeah.
Like, he was just like, that was amazing.
I think I saw where it was either, I think it was Glenn Frey was a little salty about that.
The Eagles are a little salty. I mean, in the song,
they have been litigious.
For some Steely Dan nerdery trivia, in Hotel California, there's a lyric, they can stab us with their steely knives, but they just can't kill the beast. It's a reference to the Steely Dan record that came out a year before. There's a derogatory line about the Eagles.
Oh, really?
So they're...
Yeah.
They're a little defensive.
Well, yeah, Don Henley's sort of a well-known dick.
Yeah, I know. let's get into it. Yeah.
Well, I don't know where I heard it. It was Jeff Bridges interviewed, and he knew Glenn Frey, and he said that he always kind of gave him a hard time, and you could tell it sort of bugged him a little bit. Like, he didn't want to appear as though he was taking it too seriously, but he was like, he kind of didn't love that.
Well, you know what? I have a problem with humorless people. So if you can't have a sense, if that line was like fucking Dr. Dog, I would be like honored.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. And of course, making Jesus a pedophile was such a weird Coen Brothers thing to do.
You pederast.
Yeah, pederast. There's no reason to whatsoever. But you get that funny as hell shot of him knocking on the door and that big dude just comes and it's such a Coen Brothers cut to like, not show what happens.
Oh, yeah.
Just show that uncomfortable moment.
Like he's wearing those horrible short, like those Daisy Dukes. Like, oh, my God, that scene is so real.
Apparently, he stuffed his crotch with a bag of bird seed for that shot.
Oh, that's such a good thing to learn.
Yeah, yeah, that's good.
I can't wait to tell everyone that. That's amazing.
Julianne Moore and David Thewlis, one of the funniest scenes in her entrance, that crazy entrance when she goes flying through the air with that banshee scream painting.
Yeah.
It's just so funny.
Log jamming.
Yeah, oh my God.
They put on log jamming.
Yeah.
And then, of course,
your problem with Dinah Cobble.
Yeah, Dinah Cobble.
So funny.
And then there's like that Kraftwerk reference. The band's called Autobahn.
Well, that's another funny line, though. Speaking of his clever one-liners, when she says, you know, you can imagine what happened after that. And he goes, he fixes her cable. And like, no one laughs. I'm like, man, that's hysterical. Why is
he fixes
no one
her cable?
Yeah.
He's a good man.
Yeah.
And thorough. Then there's that whole ridiculous conversation happening, the phone conversation where he's just like,
yeah,
you're speaking in a different language in front of me. You know, like,
yeah.
He's always left out in some way.
Yeah.
And he's always being forced to just be like, it's almost like an old Buñuel film where you're the song, the band song, The Wait, is actually based on a Buñuel film. And the common trope in Buñuel films was like, you're just trying to do your best.
Yeah.
And people just keep putting weights on your back, you know? And I think about the dude in that way a lot where it's just like, man, this guy just can't get a break. But like, it's a testament to his dudeness. His you're being very undude.
Yeah.
Right now.
You kind of wonder what this is a week in the guy's life. And you kind of wonder what the rest of his life is usually like, because you get the picture that nothing ever happens to him.
Yeah.
And he's all caught up in this thing. Mm-hmm. And his poor car is just getting abused through the whole movie, that piece of shit car.
Yeah. We got a team of people working night and day. They're working in shifts.
Yeah. So you got any leads?
You got any leads? Leads? Yeah. There's that aspect to it. And there's also the part of it. There's like, he is a deadbeat. I mean, he's not paying rent on time. He's writing a check for his
landlord.
He's writing these checks for under a dollar so he can make White Russians. You know, it's like his life doesn't seem that remarkable. And he's also laziest, which would put him in the running for laziest worldwide.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Well, and he's a very, you haven't lived in LA, have you?
I don't think I could ever live in LA.
But do you feel like you know LA?
Oh, I know. Well, we were just recorded our new record there. So yes, I do.
I lived there for like 5 years, and I lived, like I said, down the street from Lebowski Lanes in a little apartment kind of like that. And there, that character is a very LA kind of guy.
Oh yeah.
Like these dudes that just burn out in the 60s and stay there paying $500 a month in rent.
Yeah.
Wearing his house coat to Ralph's. Like, I saw those people.
Oh, I bet you did. Especially if you were living there in the late 90s or early
2000s. Yeah, late 90s, early 2000s.
Yeah, so now, I mean, now LA is like...
Yeah, it's a little shinier.
For the listeners, I'm like pretending to Botox my face right now. There's that aspect of LA. Then there's also like the health nut aspect of LA.
Yeah.
That old bohemian like... Yeah, man, I moved out here. I actually moved out to Frisco for the dead. And then when that scene kind of dried up, I moved down to L.A. And
absolutely, man. Those dudes are out there.
Yeah, they're fried.
Yeah.
I call it sunburnt brain.
Yeah.
The L.A., like the old L.A. dude brain. Yeah. It's like you're just, your mind is soaked by sunlight.
Yeah, and too much melatonin.
Too much melatonin.
It's good for a bit, but.
You're like, yeah. Yeah. But I'm an East Coaster.
Yeah.
So when I'm in L.A., I'm like. You know, I always say the difference between East Coast and West Coast people is like on the East Coast, if I ever said like, hey, I really think I should go to therapy, everyone would be like, what the fuck's wrong with you? Why are you going to therapy? And then in LA, I'm like, I'm going to therapy. And like, that's just so great.
Yeah.
You just do that.
Right.
You just do that.
Like your dog goes to therapy in LA.
Your dog gets, your cat gets massages in LA.
Such a weird place.
Yeah.
And so not real.
Yeah.
And it is weird out there now. Like Hollywood is... It's not like I want everything to remain a piece of shit. Like, I'm all for cleaning things up, but it's weird being in Hollywood now.
Well, there is like a Mad Max vibe happening in L.A. now that's a little, like a tent city.
Mm-hmm.
There's like a sub-city to L.A. that's like just people on the streets.
Yeah.
It's weird.
It is weird.
It's very like post-apocalyptic, and it just goes to show you like, the infrastructure there, like the money's not going to the right places.
Yeah.
You know, it's like the you have like this immaculate Church of Scientology, and then you have like these tent people.
Yeah.
You know, and like there should be more of an effort to help.
But yeah.
I don't know if there is. It's LA.
Yeah, no, it's a weird place.
It's brutal.
We should talk really quickly about the chief of police of Malibu scene.
Oh.
One of the great scenes. Because at one point, someone like the dude would have been welcome in Malibu, like in the 60s probably.
Definitely.
But now it's, you know, stay out of my beach community.
Stay out of my beach community.
He's so aggressive and angry. He's got those short pants.
Oh, man. When he whacks him, yeah. He's like, oh, it's so good. Again, it's totally Buñuel. It's totally like the Coen brothers referencing this, like, classic filmmaking, but through the lens of, like, slapstick.
Yeah.
But you do feel for him. You're like, his only form of identification is a Ralph's card. He's got no ID. This guy's
off
the grid.
And that's always been good enough.
That scene is unbelievable. He's already been through so much. He thinks he's figured it out. He's in the belly of the beast.
Yeah.
You know, he's at the house. And then he going over to the post-it pad.
Oh, with the Jackie Treehorn.
The Jackie Treehorn post-it pad.
Cock and balls.
Oh, it's like, how did they do that?
I know, man.
What were they thinking? Oh, how could they think on that level?
Yeah.
It's perfect.
Yeah.
He's like, I'm going to bust the crime now. What?
Yeah. And the only time you see him move quickly in the movie, too. And he, like, runs back over and sits down and crosses his legs.
Oh,
it's such a funny juxtaposition to his usual gait.
It's brilliant. Man, there's so many sections of the movie I want to get a handle on. I mean, the fact that his landlord is doing a cycle and it's Stravinsky.
Yeah.
So I'm a composer.
Uh-huh.
When I'm not playing drums, I, like, write for, I just wrote a string quartet.
Oh,
like,
wow.
So that scene, like, got me.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
The first time I saw it, I'm like, there's no way they're referencing Stravinsky right now.
Yeah.
Like, there's no way. How are they getting away with this?
Yeah.
Like, you know, the music in that movie is already incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, opening with Man and Me, T-Bone Burnett's music supervision on the movie is like...
It's very soundtrack heavy for Coen's.
It's soundtrack heavy, but it always feels integral to what's happening.
Yeah,
and the fact
that
they use the Man and Me as like the theme for the movie
such a great music cue.
Oh my God, it's so good. And but then you have like you have the Man in Me, and then you have this like, you know, a forgotten about Kenny Rogers song.
Yeah.
But people don't even know that that's a Kenny Rogers song.
Oh yeah,
you know, like,
and he does that song live now.
Yeah, I bet he does.
I don't know if he took it back out, but I got the feeling he probably did.
Oh, I bet he does. I mean, it's such an outlier for him, because when you think Kenny Rogers, you're like, oh, Chicken, man.
Right, right. Yeah.
A general, like, whoa, Kenny Rogers. Uh-huh. That's like an icon. But he wrote this great psychedelic song. But the Stravinsky cue, like, when he's on top of the chair, and there's like four people there.
That's such an LA thing, too.
But Walter's there, too.
Oh, I love it. Well, and the dude is so sweet when he asks him, you know, about the rent or whatever, and he says, you know, I got the performance or whatever, and he's such a sweetheart. He goes, I'll be there, man.
And he's there.
Like, and he's there. He showed up.
Yeah.
You know?
Aren't they talking about burgers in that scene, too? Like, let's go get a burger, or let's go, or...
Yeah, I think so.
Oh, my God.
I mean, he's a good guy.
He's
a
good guy. He's just... Yeah.
He just wanted that rug.
He really just wanted that rug. Yeah. All right. What else you got for me?
Well, I'm looking to see what else we should cover. Of course, I have Log Jammin' on here.
Log Jammin'.
Some of my favorite lines. Hell, I can get you a toe by 3 o'clock this afternoon with nail polish when they're talking about in the diner with the toe.
That I've completely. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. When Walter's like,
Walter says it.
I can get you a toe by 3 o'clock this afternoon. Like, to the dude, that was the evidence. Like, no, man, there was a toe. And Walter's like,
yeah.
Get a toe.
Get a toe. Oh my God, that is a funny line. But that's what you know. I've seen this movie so many times now, and there's always a line that gets me.
Yeah, sure.
Last night, the line that got me was "The aggression will not stand." Because you see the beginning of the movie, and there's George Bush on the TV. He says, "This aggression against Kuwait,
right,
will not stand."
Yeah,
and so it's like the dude will often repeat things that he's heard later. He does it again later in the movie when they're in the limo.
Uh-huh.
And he's like, she's a trophy wife, you know.
Yeah.
Like he heard somebody else say that and is now using it as his statement.
Yeah, yeah.
He does that a lot in the movie.
He does.
And I love that little detail because he's like, he is still kind of aloof. And like, he does, he's like still like, I don't know who I am.
Yeah.
So like, he hears these things and then uses them, like tries to confidently use them. But in the limo, it's not working.
No, and he's just stumbling through that whole scene.
He says trophy wife, like in the parlance of our times.
Right. Well, which is another line that Walter used, right?
Walter, he steals it from Walter.
Yeah, yeah.
In the parlance of our times.
That's so funny. I didn't really notice that.
Yeah, he repeats a lot of things that he's heard.
Yeah.
And it's great. It's a subtle detail.
Yeah, and that's so Coen's too. They're so precise.
Yeah.
Like, there are no accidents.
No accidents.
In their movies.
No. Not at all.
The only line I read that was literally the only line that was improvised that they allowed was human paraquat.
Human paraquat?
You're human paraquat. Which I had to even look up. I didn't even know what it was. I heard
what
that line.
It?
Paraquat was an herbicide that was used to spray like marijuana fields very controversially that was banned and outlawed. So to call someone a human paraquat is such a funny thing.
I want to say something about Lebowski and the Coen brothers in general that like I kind of feel is a lost art. And you're mentioning this to me. And I feel like Paul Thomas Anderson is sort of like the next generation of this, but like just deep references.
Yeah.
Like a movie becomes Infinite Jest or something.
Mm-hmm.
Like I love stuff like that where you're like you're just digging. You're like, what's a now? You're like, what's a paraquat, and how does that
right.
relate to it? Or like, you know, or even in like Kids in the Hall, Brain Candy, like the thalidomide reference.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a certain innocence to that sense of humor, and it's brilliant. But like, it reminds me of like Jack Handy's writing for SNL, like the golden era of SNL, and there's all these deep references, like Lothar of the Hill People. You're like, and then you're like, you find yourself like going back and you're like, Unfrozen Caveman Lawyer. You know, like just stuff like that where you're like, what is this based off of? Like, what, how, if I'm gonna like go back in time, like, how do I connect the dots? And the Coen brothers are like masters of that. And they're in, if you will, it is no dream.
Mm-hmm.
The line that Walter walks in, but he's like,
that's right.
Theodore Herzl.
Mm-hmm.
The Israeli leader. You're like, I have found myself Wikipediaing Theodore Herzl about that line. If you will, it is no dream.
Yeah.
And then the Coen brothers are Jewish. So I'm like, I'm wondering, like, is that a quote that they liked?
Or right,
like,
right.
Why does Walter say that? And then you're like, oh, Walter has become Jewish.
He converted, so he probably studied up.
He's like studying up and he's like trying his best to be like, I'm practicing Shomer Shabbos.
Right.
And I'm like, I don't roll. I sure as shit don't roll on Saturdays. You know, it's like, I just love that. And of course, like there's a theme of Jewish culture throughout all the Coen brothers movies, like Barton Fink.
Yeah.
The sort of like, the insecurities and the anxiety of being, I'm also Jewish, so I can totally like
certainly a simple man.
Oh my God, a simple man's like
that's the whole movie.
The whole movie is like the anxiety, the post Holocaust anxiety of being Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
Like I see these themes running throughout the whole movie, and it even like is in The Big Lebowski, which like for some people is just like a frat guy movie.
Yeah, which is it sells it so short.
It sells it so short, it bums me out that it has acquired that sort of superficial like dorm room.
Yeah, yeah. Poster. There's a lot more going on there.
There's so much going on in the movie. The movie is a work of art.
Yeah.
I fully believe it's one of their masterpieces. And like,
absolutely.
Again, you could write books and books upon on like the minutiae of that movie.
And people have done it.
And people have done it.
I finish up here. Mm-hmm. I mean, we could do this for 3 hours, I feel like.
Yes.
I finish up here with a couple of segments, one called What Ebert Said, and then five questions. And I always like to go back and see what Roger Ebert thought about these films.
This movie is a complete disappointment.
And he loved Lebowski.
Mm-hmm.
He gave it 4 stars and said, The Big Lebowski is about an attitude, not a story. It's easy to miss that because the story is so urgently pursued. This is a plot and dialogue that perhaps only the Coen brothers could have devised. I'm thinking less of their clarity in Fargo and No Country for Old Men than of almost hallucinatory logic of Raising Arizona and the Hudsucker Proxy. Only a steady hand in the midst of madness allows them to hold it together. That and the delirious richness of their visual approach.
Beautiful.
Yeah, very cool.
Thank you, Roger, for believing in this movie.
It's always disappointing when he hates the movie that I love.
This movie was a pretty big commercial clunker for them, right? Like it wasn't.
Yeah.
It just didn't really do. It didn't do Fargo numbers, and it definitely didn't do the next movie,
Oh Brother.
It didn't do Oh Brother numbers at all. You know, those were like acclaimed films.
Yeah, it's lived on.
Yeah.
More than any other films, probably.
I've gotten so deep with Lebowski. I'm like, you know, it's kind of like Dr. Dog. Like,
yeah,
it's like underappreciated when it came out. And then it's just like this slow build.
Right.
You know, like Lebowski is just like a slow build.
You're the Dr. Dog of,
it's the Dr. Dog of movies.
All right. And then five questions with Eric Slick.
Here we go.
First movie you remember seeing in the movie theater.
Oh, that would be Home Alone.
Oh, okay.
I saw Home Alone with my family, and it was like an iconic moment. And I was 3 years old. So I was cognizant and I was aware that the theater was erupting in pandemonium.
Yeah. I still stand by that movie.
Home Alone. Oh, yeah. Love Home Alone.
Fun movie.
It's pretty brutal. Those two guys would have been dead after the first paint bucket hit their faces.
Sure.
Their skulls would have been collapsed. But yeah.
I remember laughing so hard at that sequence, the break-in sequence.
It's cartoony. Like, and then you have Home Alone 2, which is the same movie.
I don't even know if I saw that one.
Home Alone 2 is the same film. Watch it again. It's the same film. They just farted that one out.
Yeah,
they're like, and then he'll befriend another lonely old person in the movie. And this time she likes pigeons instead of salting the sidewalks.
First R-rated movie you saw?
The first R-rated movie I saw was called The Groove Tube. My family.
I know that movie.
My family was very liberal. To an extreme degree where they didn't believe in censorship.
Mm-hmm.
And I really appreciate that about them. And my parents bonded over this movie called The Groove Tube, which was like a sketch comedy movie. It's Chevy Chase's first film.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's pretty raunchy. And I saw it when I was 4. And it became like a family classic. They'd fast forward through some parts of the movie, like some gratuitous nudity scenes.
Yeah.
But there was a lot of F-bombs and a lot of, you know, there's a whole, like, stoner heroin sequence in that movie. It's like, I can't believe my parents showed me that film. Awesome. And then they showed me Pink Floyd's The Wall when I was 5.
Wow.
With the meat grinders.
Yeah.
And, like.
Boy, I was into that in high school.
Oh, yeah. Who wasn't? I was into it in high school also. those were the first two R-rated movies I saw, and I was, like, 4 and 5.
That's good.
My parents are cool. Very cool people.
Will you walk out of a bad movie?
Oh, I've walked out of one movie before, and then I went back the next day and saw it again.
Whoa.
I was on a date, and I saw the movie Funny Games, which is a brutal, brutal film.
The original foreign film or the remake?
The remake that was produced by the David Lynch actress. I'll remember something. Naomi Watts.
Oh, right.
Naomi Watts, like, produced it with the original director. It's a shot-for-shot remake.
Yeah, yeah.
But it is so violently brutal. And,
yeah.
But I like, loved it. But my date did not love it. And she was like,
got out of there for her.
Got out of there after about a half hour. Mm-hmm. And she was like, yo, we're not watching this film. And I was like, yeah, cool. But then the next day, I was like, that film ruled. and, of course, it's, like, soundtracked by John Zorn. So I was like, this is my bread and butter, you know, like, murder movie with John Zorn soundtrack. Sign me up. And I also knew that the movie was a statement piece, so it's fine. But that's the only time I've ever walked out of a movie.
That's good.
That's it.
And it was to be a gentleman of sorts.
It was to try. I was trying.
Yeah.
But the sick part of it is that I went back the next day.
It's a good movie, though.
And loved it and then bought it on DVD.
Yeah. I mean, it's a tough movie, but I did like the movie, and I saw both.
Yeah. You got it.
So this one I usually will tailor to the guest. Who is your favorite drummer of all time?
Well,
you can name a couple, you know.
No, my gut reaction has to be Ringo. Only because he was the first drummer I saw on a television. And I think a lot of people had this experience with Ringo.
Yeah.
Where you see him and you can immediately relate. And I saw him and he was goofy, but he was beating the crap out of the drums and he was like smiling. And there was just something about that. And I was already interested in the drums, but he was like my first icon, you know? And even when I drum now, people will be like, oh, you're doing your Ringo thing. And it's like, like I was saying, how things can be a part of your DNA. Like Ringo is a part of my DNA.
Yeah,
I can play Ringo all day.
Mm-hmm.
And then as time wore on, I got you know, you go through the laundry list of classic rock drummers. And then I got really into like 70s soul drummers. Mm-hmm. So my 20s and now 30s like has been dedicated to studying classic soul drummers like Bernard Purdy and Al Jackson Jr. Mm-hmm. But prior to that, I was also in a huge jazz phase. So I was like studying Tony Williams mm-hmm. and I was studying Max Roach and just all DeNardo Coleman, just like all these drummers who are like super important to me. But if there's an origin, Ringo. Ringo's the origin, but so much has spread out from that. And nowadays, I would probably say either Bernard Purdy's my favorite or a guy named James Gadson who played on all the Bill Withers stuff.
Oh, wow.
Just because like there's such a refined quality. Yeah. Bernard Purdy will also tell you that he played on all the Beatles recordings. He has this really outlandish thing. Like mm-hmm. Bernard Purdy played on 10,000 records, but he still wants to say that he played on all the Beatles records. May or may not be true.
I've always heard so much shit talking about Ringo not playing on the records.
Yeah.
And that Paul was even a better drummer.
Paul's a great drummer.
I just, I don't know. I don't believe it. I don't want to believe it.
I'll tell you why you shouldn't believe it. Because when you watch Let It Be, the whatever rough cut is out mm-hmm. online, Ringo is playing all those drums and it sounds like Ringo.
Yeah.
Ringo is 100% his touch and feel. It is sloshy. It's weird. He's left-handed playing a right-handed kit, so he always leads with his left hand.
Interesting.
So his fills always start on a rack tom or something that's kind of unconventional. It's not the drummer like the classic like linear way of doing something. Like it's always
You and know, he had that little, that cymbal sweep thing move he would do. He would like, and he never looked like he was working hard because he was such a laid back kind of guy. But when you watch those early Beatles performances, those drums are about to shake off the fucking riser.
Oh, it's the most punk rock thing. It's that there's a...
But he's wearing a suit and he's like, you know...
There's that DC performance. I think I know what you're talking about where like... Or it got remastered a couple of years ago for the Ron Howard movie.
That was so good.
The 8 days a week. But they show him, and he's just like, they didn't have sound systems back then. There was no PA system. So he's like, is trying to be heard.
On the back row.
He's trying to be heard while people are screaming at a louder decibel level than the band is being heard at.
Right.
But Ringo, Ringo is so great. And then when I was like 8 years old, I heard John Bonham and I'm like,
sure.
Then I just tried to do John Bonham. Mm-hmm. Like, I studied that stuff so deeply. And then when I was 14, I got really into prog rock. And so I studied all the Neil Peart and Bill Bruford. You know, like, you just go through the line.
Any Levon Helm in there?
Oh, totally. Okay. So when I was 17, I heard the band. And then actually for my 18th birthday, my mom bought me tickets for Levon Helm's Ramble at his...
Oh, did you go?
I went on my 18th birthday.
That's one of my life regrets.
Dude, I went on my 18th birthday and my mom just bought me a ticket. And this is how cool my parents are. They're like, yeah, just figure out a way to go up there. Mm-hmm. I'm 18. I have no idea what I'm doing. I took a Greyhound up to Woodstock.
Wow.
Didn't get a hotel. Didn't realize that I needed a hotel.
Uh-huh.
And after the show's over, I'm hanging out with Levon. And I'm like, hey, man, you're one of my favorite drummers. Like, do you know any hotels around here?
Did you stay there?
No. Levon was like, I'd offer it up, but we already got guests staying. But normally, I would let you stay here. You know, like, he was like, I'll give you the shirt off my back.
Yeah, he's man. Very, such a sweetheart.
Very Southern gentleman kind of guy.
I was able to see him. My buddy that is coming tonight, Eddie, and I saw him on that last tour that he did in Atlanta, which was just like bucket list shit. But we always wanted to get to a Ramble, and we thought we had time, and we didn't.
The band that I got to see was really good, too. It was like Levon and Jimmy Vivino from the Conan band was playing guitar. This is back when Conan was still in New York, so this is a long time ago. And Hubert Sumlin, who was Howlin' Wolf's guitar player, was playing guitar.
Wow.
And then his daughter came out, Amy. Uh-huh. And it was just a great night. Like, they played Evangeline, and they didn't do any band songs. They did, like, a bunch of Dylan stuff. They did Don't You Tell Henry. They did a lot of Basement Tape stuff.
Wow.
But it was just a riot, man. It was so fun.
And
I had a blast.
Man.
He was amazing to watch. I wish,
what a great thing.
You know, like, this was before iPhone, so I was just there.
Yeah, man.
I was just present watching Masters in a barn.
Yeah.
You know, and then there's like a picture of Richard Manuel and a picture of Rick Danko above the stage. But yeah, just, you know, I went through a heavy Helm phase, man. For sure.
They're probably my favorite band.
Good call.
Although,
as the time wears on with their stuff, the records get a little bit spottier, but.
Through their career. Yeah, yeah.
But you get, you know, with Northern Light, Southern Cross, you get It Makes No Difference, which is like one of the most heartbreaking, beautiful songs of all time. So.
Well, that's why Dr. Dog always kind of reminded me a little bit of the band, was not even so much the music, but the juxtaposition of the two voices of Scott and Toby. And the band had, you know, like Richard Manuel, man, like maybe the most soulful white dude you've ever heard.
Yeah.
And then this Southern hillbilly with Levon. And then Rick Danko, and like
permanently nervous voice.
Yeah.
Oh, what's my favorite one? Crazy Chester followed me. He's just always so nervous.
Oh man, I hate that we lost all those guys.
I know, me too, man.
And we're left with Robbie,
but
who's a genius. But Robbie kind of likes to hear himself talk.
Check this out, though. My first concert ever, which I don't remember, but my first concert ever was Ringo Starr and his all-star band.
Oh, wow. He always has great people.
But the first year he did it was 1989. Mm-hmm. My parents took me. That was my first show. And the band was Levon, Rick Danko, and Jim Keltner, who is a famous, Keltner played on all the George Harrison records. Uh-huh. Phenomenal drummer. But that was my first concert. So it was Ringo and the band. So it makes a lot of sense that I would gravitate towards a band like Dr. Dog. Like,
that's great.
That's just in there, you know?
And the band was always famous for other people wanting to be in the band. Like Eric Clapton wanted to be in the band.
That's why he made Blind Faith.
Yeah. Like every time one of them, they were like, well, that's the group I wanted to be in.
Oh, yeah. They were a musician's band.
Yeah.
Because they were really playing.
And they came up with the Hawks, and they were like, they had their chops.
They were players.
Yeah.
They could do it. But the Clapton story is that he broke up Cream when he heard the first band record, music from Big Pink, because he was like, this is what I want to do. This is pointless.
They were doing something so different for the time, too. I mean, that was, the band was making that kind of music when, like, Jimi Hendrix was making his kind of music.
They're kind of like the first hipster band in a way, because they were doing everything that was antithetical to what was happening. So you have this like, the line from The Last Waltz? He's like, there are all these bands like Marshmallow Overcoat. Strawberry Alarm Clock, Marshmallow Overcoat.
Yeah.
And then you have the band, and it's just so pure and so acoustic sounding in a time when everything was like, wow. Everything was a wash. You get this band that's like real, like there's no picture of them on the album cover.
Yeah.
The famous thing was, the photographer for the band, Elliot Landy, the label Capitol was like, we want to get you the best photographers because you're going to be the best band. You're the band. And Robbie Robertson was like, can you find the worst photographer? Uh-huh. And somebody at the label was like, what? And they're like, well, there's this guy, Elliot Landy, who writes for Cream magazine, who is the worst photographer I've ever seen.
Uh-huh.
And he ended up doing the band's photos, and he does the
National those iconic photos there on the farm.
All those photos are Elliot Landy. All those iconic photos, and Nashville Skyline, which is one of the most incredible album covers.
Yeah.
Just goes to show you that, like, you just gotta go against the grain as much as you can, right? Like,
did you ever see Festival Express?
Oh yeah,
yeah.
I Shall Be Released from Festival Express is like, top notch. And you know, funny you should mention it, like every year in New York at the Capitol Theater in Westchester, I'm part of a Last Waltz. We do the complete Last Waltz, all 4 hours of it. Toby's done it, Scott's done
that's
it,
that's great.
My girlfriend Natalie's done it.
I might have to go to that.
We're doing it again this year.
When is it?
It's like a week before Thanksgiving.
Okay, because they do a similar thing in Atlanta at this place, Smith's Old Bar. They do the Last Waltz thing.
Yeah, I've played Smith's a bunch.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome. The complete Last Waltz is fun, though, because you do all the stuff that's not in the movie.
Yeah, yeah.
So you're doing like these weird Neil Young, like, with Seasides, Four Strong Winds, and then you do Joni Mitchell's Coyote, which is in the movie, but then you do like Ferry Sings the Blues,
wow,
which is like Court and Spark song that's like super long and weird.
Uh-huh.
And then there's a lot of blues jams
that
you got to do.
Yeah.
They're just biding their time, waiting for Neil Young to finish up his cocaine.
Mountain of cocaine. He's so twitchy in that movie.
Oh, I feel like before you've asked me this last question, you know that they edited out his coke booger. That's like the...
Yeah, I've heard that. He had you could see it on film, right?
Scorsese edited it out. Edited it. Yeah. It's gone.
Coke booger. That's a good band name.
There you go.
All right. And finally,
yes.
Boy, we just went down the band rabbit hole.
Sorry.
That's easy for me to do.
Yeah.
And I brought it up.
Yep.
Movie going 101 with Eric Slick.
Here we go.
What's your ritual like at the movie theater? Where do you sit? What do you get at the concession stand?
Oh, man. I feel like this is such a indicative of my personality, but I walk right up the stairs and I go directly in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
I go right in the middle because I like to be at eye level with the screen.
Okay.
I've had so many situations where I showed up late to the theater and I got to sit all the way up front and I'm like squinting to see Borat or like I've been all the way in the back and I can't hear everything. So I try to go early enough to sit really close. And then, you know, if I'm alone, I get Reese's Pieces.
Okay.
If I'm with
Natalie. Because you don't want to share?
No, if I'm alone, I'm just like, I get the king size Reese's Pieces and
indulge.
I indulge. And maybe that's like an E.T. like a subconscious connection to movies and what candy I should be eating at movies.
Right.
But if I'm with Natalie, we either get popcorn or sometimes we'll even like sneak snacks in her purse.
Yeah, that'll move.
We live two blocks away from the Criterion Cinema in Virginia. So we're loving it.
Reserve seating there?
There's no reserve seating.
Okay.
But it's Virginia, and like not a lot of people are going to the Criterion part. Usually they're going to the main cinema.
Yeah.
And the Criterion is sort of the
art house.
It's the art house one. So like when there's a new Woody Allen movie or something, we'll go, or, you know, if there's some movie we need to see, we check it out.
And nice.
That's our little, that's about as much of a ritual as we can do. It's usually a movie is like, well, it looks like crap outside, so
right.
We should go see a movie.
Yeah. Good stuff.
Yeah, man.
All right, dude, this was great.
Oh, it's so fun.
What a fun talk.
Oh, absolutely. I feel like I could have gone for another 4 hours.
I know. I'll have you back in a year.
Oh, please. I would love to come back.
For sure.
Yeah, man.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, everybody. Another one in the can. That was a good one. Just to follow up, Eric was kind enough to put me and my buddy Eddie on the guest list for Dr. Dog that night with backstage passes. We went down to the Tabernacle and saw the band, and they were awesome. Went backstage, hung out with the boys, and it was a lot of fun. One of the great nights. And we talked a little bit about music and privately, like, you know, what's it like out there playing all these shows day after day, and don't you get bored and sick of it? And they were pumped after the show, and he came back and he was like, dudes, he went, you just saw a perfect Dr. Dog show. And he was like, good for you. We hit on all cylinders. Everyone had a great time. Because I always wonder, you know, when I'm seeing a band, you know, it looks like they're enjoying it most times. But he was like, you read it right. This is a good one. So support that band. They're awesome. Go out and get their new album, Critical Equation, that was out this year, or any of their records. They're all great. Just really, really good dudes. So thanks to Eric and thanks to Dr. Dog for helping to hook this up. And thanks for listening. And until next time, I've said it before and I'll say it again. Once you get yourself a musical instrument, learn to play it and go out and make some noise. Movie Crush is produced, engineered, edited, and soundtracked by Noel Brown and Ramsey Yunt at HowStuffWorks Studios, Ponce City Market, Atlanta, Georgia.